This episode of LedgerCast is brought to you by me. Go to ledgerstatus.com/learn to see if it's right for you. With Learn, you're going to get an introduction to technical analysis and fundamental analysis as well. You'll also get weekly market updates. If you don't want to dedicate a ton of time to learning technical analysis from all the different sources out there, I try to pull together the most important factors in the market so that you can invest and trade in the cryptocurrency markets effectively. I hope you'll enjoy it. Check it out if you are interested. Go to ledgerstatus.com/learn. Hello and welcome to LedgerCast. My name is Brian Krogsgaard. Today I'm with Tor Bear. Tor, you know, I should know your full title, but I don't. He does stuff at Enigma.
That's pretty accurate.
Enigma does a lot of interesting things. We will talk about it a little bit. However, the purpose of today's call is we're talking about fundamentals, because sometimes when all else is equal and you see, 100 altcoin charts that look the same, how can you screen and determine what's something that you want to be invested in, and how to screen for fundamentals, how to, see differences from one project to another? That's what we're going to discuss today. This is not directly related to Enigma. This is not Tor telling you to buy Enigma or speculating on price for Enigma. It does have a token. That's all relevant. It's actually one where I think the fundamentals are fine. We're going to learn a little bit about what Tor does and why I think he's good to, you know, teach us about screening for fundamentals. But just as our upfront disclosure, this is not some sort of recommendation to buy or sell or whatever else with Enigma directly. Tor, did I do that okay?
I think that was all perfect, man.
It was sufficient?
You've represented me well. Right. Even though you don't know exactly what I do, I could be honest and say that I'm not sure some days either. But stuff is pretty accurate, and we can get into all the stuff I do and don't do
What's your actual title? I think you have marketing something or another in your title.
I do, yeah. So my official title is the head of growth and marketing at Enigma. And I always emphasize the growth piece, because that's what I consider essential to any project in this space, is kind of having a growth mindset towards, you know, making sure all this stuff works at scale. And it's the biggest failure that I see sometimes in the space, is if people focus too much on what's already working and not how it's going to work for the next 1,000 or 1,000,000 people who might show up and try to use an application or a protocol. You know, you always have to keep that perspective. Just so happens that growth has a lot to do with marketing and communication, and how you talk about what you're building and who's building it. It's all connected. That's really what the title means.
So, you know, my audience is one of traders, mostly, I would say, but also some people that are looking for longer term investments, looking for something where they can buy it when it's attractive from a trade perspective, but then they can feel comfortable sitting on it for a while, maybe even over a year, which is almost unheard of in big swinging bull markets in crypto. But in these mass accumulation zones, we see a lot of altcoins in from a chart perspective. You know, it's not unheard of to put some money into things when they're basing or whatever you want to call it from a TA perspective, and then, you know, wait for the fundamentals to shine. So let's just preface this conversation with, it's a trader / investor audience, but you know, in this landscape, I find it hard. So I'm imagining other listeners do too. I find it pretty hard sometimes to separate the good stuff from the bad stuff. So why don't we start by, how did you get attracted to the project you ended up working for? Like, that, you obviously had to say, hey, this is one that makes sense to me. I believe in the fundamentals of this project enough to work for them. So how did you even get to that point? How did you make those initial connections to say this was worthwhile to spend your career on?
So my background actually is pretty relevant to your audience, as the first 5 years of my post-undergraduate career, I was a derivatives trader. So I was an options market maker in Chicago. And when you talk about holding something for a year, 22-year-old me thinks that's pretty crazy, because I was an options trader at the time, and we wouldn't hold things for any longer than a day. The whole point of market making being to get back to a flat position, right? Yeah. You don't want exposure to anything. So if you had talked to me then, it would have seemed crazy to think about the fundamentals of anything. And I think at that stage in my life, I was pretty mercenary. I was thinking, you know, just what can I get involved with for the near term, which is why I eventually stopped. You know, trading wasn't going to be my life. It wasn't going to be my career. But I went from trading back into business school. So I went to MIT for business school starting in 2014. And that's when I really started getting into blockchain technology more generally, because I was an economics major, which is how I got dragged into trading. But what I really liked was behavioral economics. I liked incentive design. I liked the structures of systems. And blockchain and Bitcoin in particular seemed super fascinating. At the time, like the Ethereum presale was going on. There was so much stuff to get involved in and look at. And at the same time, it wasn't nearly as noisy as what you saw in the last couple of years.
Yeah, were people at MIT pretty interested in crypto in 2014?
They're huge nerds, so yeah. But on the other hand, the MIT Bitcoin Club did this thing. First of all, they had a Bitcoin Club at MIT, which is cool enough as it is.
Yeah.
At the time, they did this thing where they gave away $100 in Bitcoin to, I think it was every undergraduate. It might have been every student at the university. And what I heard was overwhelmingly, they all sold it immediately. I think Bitcoin at the time was still a three-digit enterprise. I think.
Oh yeah.
So like
2014.
So they were giving students like half a Bitcoin. Yeah. And they were like, "Yeah, I'm just going to sell that for the $100, and I'm going to go buy pizza." And I think a lot of people may be still regretting that investment decision at this time. So they may have been nerds, but I don't think they really understood necessarily the potential of the technology.
Were you looking
but it
at
wasn't
it
for lack of trying.
Were you looking at it as an investment vehicle since you were back in school coming from a finance world?
I actually knew about Bitcoin back in 2011, 2012, because when you're an options trader, you're a volatility junkie. So you just look at whatever's moving. And I can tell you that at the stock market at the time, it was very low volatility. Nothing was really going on.
So it was recovery from the financial crisis. And on a chart perspective, it's like this very like leveling off kind of rising hump look about it. I don't know what you call that, but it was.
I would call it boring.
Yeah, boring is a good word for what it was.
We certainly all thought so. So we instead started looking at the stuff that was moving. And that's when I said, okay, this Bitcoin thing is stupid. Like it's going up, you know, hundreds of percentages and then crashing, you know, the same order of magnitude. And it just seemed like such an insane thing because I only saw it as a price on a screen. And we traded it like a line chart. So I came to it as a trader. It's true. But this was 6 or 7 years ago. So I've had the benefit of seeing a few market cycles from the trading side while simultaneously becoming a builder, or, you know, while I'm not like actively developing our protocol or anybody else's, you know, I have a large responsibility for how the project grows long term.
Yeah.
And it sort of mellows out your perspective because the lines on the chart mean a little bit. It means something a little bit different when you actually know what's going on under the hood to some extent. And you can separate what you see in the market, which you know is just a function of liquidity and sentiment, from what you see as the potential of the underlying technology, which, as you're saying, you know, it comes back to fundamentals. And the one piece of advice that, you know, we can start with and hammer as many times as we want is like, just don't get confused and see, like, don't think that price leads fundamentals. But don't get confused and also think that fundamentals is going to lead price, right? Like, you just have to treat the two in tandem, not assume that they have any sort of relationship to each other, especially if you're looking only on short time horizons. You just have to learn both skill sets separately and use them together to have a holistic view of you know, one asset, one crypto asset in particular, or the space as a whole. You just, there's no way around it. Like, you can't just be a specialist, I think, if you're trying to be in this space for the long term.
Yeah. So I want to learn a little bit more how you evolved from knowledge of crypto to working in the space. It's funny, the way you mention it was similar to me. I painfully, I've even searched my non-crypto Twitter account for my first ever mention of Bitcoin. And it was back in 2012, right as it was breaking up from that really tight consolidation zone. From like $5 or $6.
yeah.
So I had I had plenty of awareness. I've been in tech from a web perspective. I've been a web developer for a long time, and so I've had awareness from it. Been in the stock market for a long time, and for some reason, I always thought of Bitcoin as like a transactional thing, not so much as a investment thing. Right. Purely, and I didn't really think of it that way. So I don't think that was uncommon at the time, and not really until the two broadly covered hype cycles, one being the 2013 one and then again in 2017, did it really come in more into its whatever people think of it now as like a thing that you can buy and make money off of holding on to.
Sure.
So you got out of the MIT business program, and did you go directly into blockchain stuff or crypto stuff?
Well, I had a couple things happen, and you know, I'm a recurring theme over the course of this call might be that I'm not really that, you know, smart. I'm just in the right place at the right time on a lot of things. You know, and I've also been in some places at the wrong time, so I'm not like a particularly lucky guy, but in this case I was, because as I was going through the business school at MIT had just started not only having the Bitcoin Club, but teaching blockchain courses. So I took the first ever blockchain engineering course that was taught at MIT. And I also took the first business of blockchain focused course that MIT taught. Wow. And one of the instructors for the engineering focused blockchain class was a guy named Guy Ziskind, who at the time was a researcher at the MIT Media Lab. And I was sitting in that class, you know, listening to him talk about the ins and outs of blockchain technology and some of this groundbreaking research he was doing on privacy technologies. And I'm sitting there, you know, in a classroom of the people who are from the legitimate graduate schools at MIT, you know, the engineers and the computer scientists and such. And here I am, one of the two or three business school students in the room, thinking, wow, I'm too dumb to be here. And it was just total, you know, fortune, because, you know, Guy is the Enigma CEO now. And, you know, his co-founder, John, was one of my classmates at the MIT Business School, and he was also sitting in that class. So they went, and, you know, Enigma is what it is today, thanks to a lot of like what they did building it from a white paper at the time into an actual protocol. And I ended up joining in mid-2017. I graduated from the business school. I worked as a data scientist for a little bit before realizing that the entire way that data is used and consumed is totally broken, and kind of returned to, you know, first principles of like, what am I just not going to be pissed off at myself about that I worked for the next decade of my life on? And, you know, you come out of MIT, technically you've got a lot of career opportunities. There was other stuff I could be doing. But from my perspective, there's only one thing that I could be doing, which is playing with this stuff, figuring out how it works, figuring out where it's going to go, because it's clear to anybody who's at least followed it for the last 5 years plus that this is going to be something, you know. The key is not trying to, you know, have too much say in what it is. It's to be responsive to how the tech is evolving and how the space is evolving, and just soaking up as much as you can. So I got dumb lucky to get into the space at all, but it was only because I was just around all the right people at the right time, and I was determined to make sure I was soaking up everything I could from the people who had also determined to make it their lives.
So how did you actually get into further conversation with Guy to, you know, figure out what Enigma is and buy into the whole thing that they're looking to solve?
Yeah, part of it is shorthand. You know, like you go to MIT, you meet the people, you know, they're good people, but that's kind of cheating. Right. And that's not really fundamental analysis. What that is like getting a taste of the actual people involved. You know, I had the great fortune of getting to meet the people directly. But I will say this, you know, Guy and John and everybody else involved with the project now are very open people, and they're very transparent about their process, and they're very transparent about their principles. So when it came time to get to know, you know, who was working on the project, at the time it was just Guy and John. I was the first hire to work on like Enigma before our token generation event. You know, I had a lot of access that I imagine a lot of, you know, investors would want to have that kind of access to projects. What I'll say is that if a project's willing to give you that kind of access and they have a very clear perspective on their mission, their technology, and their principles, that is a signal in itself. It's kind of a squishy signal, right? It's sort of like a soft principle, but it's
having a leadership team signal. That's open, transparent,
mm-hmm.
and I guess just either is bringing something significant to the forefront or has some degree of experience to that you can get behind are two important things.
Right. Yeah. I would chalk this up, you know, generally 80 to 90% of my decision to join Enigma was driven by the team. Mm. And I think that if I were an investor fundamentally looking at any project in the space or any investor looking at an early stage startup in the traditional world, I did a VC internship while I was still in business school. And it seems clear that the one thing that everybody prizes or should prize more if they don't is the quality of the team. And part of that is, you know, having a public presence. Part of that is having a clear perspective and being ethical. You know, these are all things I could judge for myself that are very hard to judge for outsiders. And yet, if you can somehow find a way to get that kind of signal about a project or about a person, it's the most reliable signal that you can have. And the other thing is they came recommended, right? I had classmates who had also worked with John. I had other classmates who had taken Guy's course and I had read his white paper and enough smart developers had told me this is groundbreaking shit. You know, all of that kind of comes together to say, it's not just up to me to kind of make this decision. You know, enough smart people think that these are, you know, great people working on a great idea. You know, we say we don't care too much about social proof maybe sometimes, but I was around enough smart people who thought they were smart. And I'm okay with being the dumbest person in the room.
That's my preferred state.
Yeah. It you learn more that way. You just have to make sure they don't get sick of you.
Yeah, exactly. So
they keep me around. They're real nice.
If you have to say, to give people at least some idea of what Enigma is and does, what's the relatively quick version of the problem that y'all are solving with Enigma?
So Enigma from its earliest stages had a very clear perspective on the problem that it was trying to solve. So the original white paper was called Decentralizing Privacy. And it was all about the idea that you could combine blockchain, you know, as like a verification layer mm-hmm. with a computation layer. And the computation layer would handle it would handle like the computations, it would preserve the privacy of data being used. And the blockchain was just there to like verify that the computation was done correctly. That was the idea of that paper. It was followed up with the Enigma white paper, which went into more detail about how you could have a decentralized computation platform with guaranteed privacy. This was 2015. So this is pre-Lambo bubble, you know, whatever else. This was like an actual white paper. And if you go back and read our white paper now, there's no formatting, you know, there's no logos, there's no...
It's an actual paper. It's not a marketing document.
Yeah, which, you know, is confusing to many people, I suppose, but, you know, that's just always what it was. So as it's evolved, you know, the original vision has always been clear. The problem we saw was that there was really no way for blockchains to work with private or sensitive data. You know, if you wanted to work with data, it had to be stored on chain, which exposed the data, and blockchains are not meant to be sort of like infinitely scalable. You know, this is not like a SegWit, you know, podcast or anything right now. But like the point about blockchains is that they're not really supposed to like handle infinite number of transactions. And that's by design. Yeah, it's supposed to be exactly. It's supposed to be accurate, auditable. You know, you're supposed to be able to trust that it's immutable. And you know, that's not 100% accurate as we're seeing with like Ethereum Classic, but you know, everything has its vulnerabilities, but that was kind of the point of a blockchain.
Yeah.
And we leaned into that. We said, okay, what if the key is not creating like another better, faster, more scalable blockchain, but actually creating a new kind of decentralized computation protocol that solves both that scalability issue and that privacy issue? So what Enigma is it's a decentralized network for secure computation where encrypted data comes into the Enigma network. It's processed by nodes in the network while still encrypted. So the nodes themselves don't see the raw data. And then the result of the computation is pushed back to the blockchain for verification.
So when you talk about computation, what are we talking like Enigma is the part that does the computation for results of people voting? Or is it like is it some kind of privacy computation? Like what's the computation that Enigma is doing?
Yeah, so it depends on what kind of privacy technology we're talking about. So for example, the first iteration of Enigma's network is focused on like hardware-based privacy solutions, but there's also like this entire field of secure computation, which is all about how you can do computations over encrypted data. And like, this is secure multi-party computation, fully homomorphic encryption. There are so many good resources that I can point people to, and I know it's not the point of this. So
no, that's fine. I'm just curious.
Yeah, no, it's all super cool stuff. So for example, I think it is good with like a tangible example. Secret voting is something that we've written about. The idea being that multiple parties can submit encrypted votes to the Enigma network. The Enigma network can, you know, cryptographically prove that it's counted the votes in a fair way. You can fairly know the outcome of the election, but the individual votes themselves are never revealed, even to the nodes themselves that are doing that counting. And it sounds like a trivial implementation, but you can't do this on chain. Like, if you don't want the votes to be known, then you can't do this on the blockchain. And this has huge implications for, you know, it's sort of a building block implementation, but it has implications for things like on-chain governance. Mm-hmm. You know, if you want to build some kind of governance technology that relies on the ability of participants in the networks to vote, and you want to preserve the privacy of the vote, or you want to prevent people from vote buying or bribery attacks, these are like very basic implementations that aren't really possible unless you have this kind of privacy preserving network. So when I say we're solving real problems, you know, when I say we're solving real problems, what I'm saying is, you know, there's these little technical implementations that we're providing solutions to, but there's also sort of this global aspect of just blockchains are always going to struggle with preserving privacy of input data, and they're always going to struggle with scalability. And we've built a protocol that's supposed to be solving both of these issues by working with blockchains, not replacing them, but, you know, we're additive to the ecosystem. That's the most exciting thing to me about working on a project like this, is we don't have to have somebody else fail for Enigma to succeed. We add something to pretty much any decentralized application or smart contract implementation that you could think of.
Okay. So somebody could create a application on Ethereum, and Enigma is part of the application that they build because they need this different type of privacy and compute layer.
Exactly.
And it's not the same.
Vitalik talks about it the same way, you know, in terms of Ethereum being part of the decentralized web stack, you know, and it is a much healthier way to think about it. I think he's got a very healthy way of talking about it, which is, you know, Ethereum is not supposed to be the whole stack. They're very concerned now with these sort of like layer two solutions. And, you know, we've accidentally always been with, you know, for the last whatever year since the project started. And now people are starting to realize like these kind of implementations are just as critical as the blockchain itself that provides the backbone. You know, Ethereum for us is the main chain that we use for verification. So it is the backbone of our network. It is where we inherit like the security properties of that chain. And they also have the most robust developer ecosystem. So it's really cool.
Yeah. All right. So let's dig into some fundamental stuff. So let's say your average project, this is about the degree to what we just did with Enigma. That's about the degree that you get in from a tech point of view. Let's talk about some other things. We've talked about, you know, you can do some homework on the team. You can do some homework, minimal homework on the problem set, how they're solving it. I want to dig into if it's an ICO or if it's not an ICO, if they have a treasury or like something like Decred, it's not an ICO, but they have a treasury from a governance perspective. Like, how do you look at a project and say, here's the money that this project, whether it's an organization or a company or whatever, here's money that they're in charge of, how they're managing it and how it's being governed, their burn rate, this kind of stuff. How do you look at that when you're looking at a project?
So and again, I want to stress that this is kind of like a general comment on how you might approach this question as an individual looking to invest long-term in a network. And when I say invest in a network, it could be, you're buying the token, but it could be like you're thinking of running a node on the network, or you're building a decentralized application on the network. These are all
stakeholders. You want to make sure that whatever you're using, you want to make sure it's going to be around 15 years from now or something.
So that is kind of exactly the key question you have to come back to, is like, okay, to the extent that having a treasury or decentralized governance the decentralized governance might impact the ability of this protocol or platform or application to be around in another 10 to 15 years, you know, that should enter your calculus. You know, if you're trying to enter like a multi-year position, you care more about something like that. If you're not, you know, you care a little bit less. You care more about, like, in the short term, what incentives exist for the network to grow. So let's say, for example, there's a project that's already publicly announced, and maybe they've somehow committed to this, that they're going to be incentivizing in the short term developers building on that platform or protocol, and mm-hmm. they're paying people in the native token for that.
Okay, on the one hand, 0x just did this, so let's keep. I want to keep down that.
I'm not.
I know you're not talking about them specifically, but that's a good. That is it's an example that comes to mind. You can keep it general. I'm going to apply some.
I'm going to keep it general. You do your thing.
Okay.
But yeah, like that's a choice that you could make as a project. You know, trying to create these kind of incentives, they might be better in the short term than the long term. Ideally, they lead to short term growth that becomes a sustainable growth engine for the long term. This is the kind of stuff I think about in a professional capacity all the time. If I'm launching some sort of incentive structure short term, how does it support the long term growth of the network? So if you pay a bunch of developers to build something, that doesn't mean you've paid a bunch of users to use it. So yeah. You could think that maybe it's useful, but not if they're not building things anybody's going to use. Maybe they've thrown a lot of money at a hackathon, but I've seen a lot of hackathon projects, you know, get abandoned. The metric that you're caring about, you know, fundamentally should be some sort of adoption, but not just by developers, but by the end users. Users have to be using the platforms. And sometimes, you know, if you're investing in a protocol, you care about the growth of the platforms built on the protocol. So you just kind of have to go all the way up. Like if you were thinking as a traditional investor, in the traditional VC space, if you're investing in something like an Amazon, you care about the success of anybody who's selling their products through Amazon. If you're investing in any kind of platform business, you care about the success of the people that are using that business as a backbone.
Those incentive programs, they remind me, I don't know if you remember when Windows Phone was trying to kick off and iOS had really blown up and Windows Phone was like, yeah, we're going to do this for Microsoft and we're going to incentivize these app developers to build a version of their app for the Windows Phone. And then the ones that did, sure, they did, and they had some incentive or whatever they got for doing so. But then that didn't mean that people bought Windows phones and used them, and therefore the apps were worth maintaining for the long term. And Windows Phone ended up being this massive, I'm assuming, massive development project for a whole lot of people that never really had people buying and using the phones. And in a lot of crypto projects, I feel like some of that's going on as well, where people are building infrastructure for stuff that they don't necessarily know even who the ideal customer is, much less like what kind of target market is there for that ideal customer. And now how do you track that back to what becomes the network value for some token on top of all of that?
Oh yeah. Token utility is a whole other kind of conversation. And there is no consensus on like what is a useful framework for that thing. Because usually these tokens don't have any kind of cash flow associated with them or something that you might use with like a traditional discounted cash flow valuation model or anything else you might see in the traditional space. But all of that aside, you know, when you're just talking about like how you evaluate a project that's paid a bunch of people to use it so their metrics look good, you know, you can imagine like it's always useful to draw analogies. If you sat in you're a venture capitalist and somebody came to you with a pitch and they were like, man, we've seen incredible growth, you know, over the last quarter. Everybody's, you know, using our ride sharing service or whatever it is. And you say, oh, how'd you get it done? You know, how did you do this? And you dig a little bit into those growth metrics. And it turns out like, you know, it's Uber. They paid people $50 to take rides on their platform. And then turns out, no, they won't show you this metric, but it turns out that all of those people, after they spent those free $50, never returned to the platform. The problem is we don't have sophisticated ways as a space, and most projects aren't necessarily transparent enough, even though it's supposed to be on chain, to show the source of their growth.
Yeah, right? So if you're doing an airdrop,
how these metrics get created.
If you're doing an airdrop of a bunch of tokens, it doesn't mean you're bringing on people that are the ideal people to actually buy and use your tokens for the.
Right, but it's social proof. Look at all the people who hold my token. You know, look at all the people who've tried my platform. Well, they all showed up because you were just giving away tokens to anybody who entered their email. You know, it's not sustainable growth tactics, but in the short term, if it's all speculators care about, it's going to get baked into that price short term. it's up to you as an investor who's trying to concentrate on fundamentals to be able to say, okay, do I care about what they're showing off in the short term? You know, if you think it's sustainable, it's one thing. If you don't care if it's sustainable, it's another. I think everybody should care if growth is sustainable, especially if you've got a long-term perspective. But, you know, in a bull market, I can tell you most people didn't care. And they honestly, they really didn't have a reason to. Now, if you haven't changed your mindset about how you're approaching, how you think about metrics, like anything that you can see from a project, forget the tech stack, forget the token utility, but just like when you're measuring something like developer adoption or users, or even if you're just looking at their social channels, like how many people are in their Telegram, you know, you might use that as an indicator and you still might not understand why that's an important number. You got to figure out if what they're doing is sustainable.
How does a project like yours or any other, how do you dig in and get the attention of the industry that it would be useful for? And like, listen, I'll use an example that's completely unrelated. Well, you could probably use Enigma on it, but like, let's say it's medical records, right? Like that's a classic, you can use a blockchain with a secure privacy layer and have people's medical records, and like every hospital can tap into this, and you know, the patient's privacy is forefront and all this other stuff. Okay, that's great. But how do you go beyond that? And how do you actually get the medical industry to buy into an idea like that?
I'll tell you, so not only is that something we've specifically thought about, it's something we specifically tried to do, because before Enigma was a public network, you know, before public networks were really an established thing you could do, you know, before Ethereum scaled, Enigma was, you know, still an idea we were trying to put into practice. Mm-hmm. And so before I joined the company, but you know, after it was founded, they were trying to find, you know, private use cases for this. And it turns out that a lot of the time, the barrier isn't even technical. It's just, you know, political internally to these industries or organizations. Imagine the kind of like political will it would take internally to the medical industry to switch everything over to a blockchain. Forget which blockchain, just anything, for anything to change, right? So, you know, you need to be able to evaluate, you know, the promises that a company might be making. You know, if they're claiming that they're going to disrupt an industry in X years, or they've got pre-existing relations, like you can pretty much discount anybody who says anything like that just because it's so utterly ridiculous if you've ever tried to get anything done in some of these industries. That said, the way to get it done is you have to find champions. You know, if you're a project that's looking to do something in a particular space, you know, you want to find a champion within that space who will do that first pilot. You know, again, it needs to be sustainable, not just somebody who's like, you know, a former coworker helped you get this pilot program done. You know, like chances are you're not going to get the next pilot and the next pilot because it was just like a one-time like throwaway partnership you tried to announce and it's meaningless. You see this all the time. What you want to look for is, you know, projects that have routinely managed to create these early stage relationships, show some sort of promise with the technology, you know, and hopefully also demonstrated the technology more broadly than like a private demonstration. And that's the kind of traction you're seeing. What you want to do is manage expectations and think that, okay, as long as they're not promising to turn this into like an industry redefining protocol in the next 12 months, you can have some confidence that they have realistic expectations for themselves. And so do their partners. If you see outlandish promises, it just makes it more likely that they'll never pull it off. It's one of those things where restraint is actually more predictive of success, long-term.
I think of that. If I use my medical records example, I could imagine a world where let's say a regional, hospital network. So they have 10 hospitals in one state or something. You land a big fish and that entire network of hospitals is going to, you know, do a pilot test of your medical records solution. They give their patients the option to opt into some, you know, web and mobile application where now their records are going to be managed on this blockchain within that one system. You could test something like that, or you could spend 2 years getting it launched. You could spend 2 years doing the initial test, another year reviewing the effectiveness of that, and then deciding whether or not you want to try to continue on or advocate it to other ecosystems or whatever. Like, it's easy to envision a world where it takes a decade or more to actually adopting some of this in a real world scenario.
this is where it comes back to the team, right? Because yeah. if you don't trust the project team to be able to build these kinds of long-term relationships, the relationships it actually takes to get this stuff done at scale, then, you know, really you're saying that you don't care if it ever gets done at all.
Yeah. So how do we translate that? Now take that example. Some mm-hmm. industries might move a little quicker, like people might be able to get adoption for whatever they're building a little better,
right.
quicker than a decade. But most of these things are going to take years probably to get real adoption, unless right. it's a niche, like unless you're building it for the blockchain world, you know, the crypto space that already gets things.
Right.
But if you're trying to build something for the broader world, then it's going right. to take time for adoption. How do you take... okay, I believe in this team. I think they can do this. I think they have the right people, the right product, the right whatever. All the fundamentals yeah. feel good. How do you backtrack that into an actual investment? Like if you're looking to put money into a token or whatever, mm-hmm. how do you try to make that decision? Is it something where you say like, I think it's wise for me to allocate 1% of my portfolio and I'm going to let it sit there for 5 years? Or right. like, do you do it at the top of a bull market? Like, how do you make those, you know what I mean? Like, how do you choose yeah. when the right time to do all that is when you're looking at things with a fundamental lens?
Timing markets is hard, right? Like, so if you've already, usually when you make a trade, you've got a time horizon in mind, not just a direction, right? You have some signposts, you know, you have on ramps and off ramps. You have times where you're going to kind of reevaluate a position that you've taken. If you come into something knowing you're trying to take a multi-year position, then you care about kind of like multi-year metrics. You may try to buy in over a longer period. Depending on how big of an investor you are, you're maybe trying to buy directly from a team or something like that. You know, there's lots of different strategies
or a
that
mixed
I've heard of.
Equity and token.
Yeah, equity is a whole other thing and probably beyond the scope of what we're doing here. Like, what's the value of equity in a yeah. project?
I doubt listeners are going to have access to equity investments, but right. it's something to consider is that could be the main
and
value
funds
driver.
Do consider, right?
Yeah.
To the extent that your listeners can invest like the most sophisticated funds in crypto, I imagine that they should, but to the extent they can't, they need to be aware of that because there are advantages that large funds have that individuals don't. You might see a large fund do something and think that it makes sense for you. And then you're just going to get in trouble because this fund bought in at a 40% discount to the market price. And now they're dumping on a retail investor when they finally get involved.
Like, one of the advantages, I agree with that. I do think relevant to where we are in crypto today is a lot of projects are tradable, at least with their utility tokens, at half or less the price of the ICO that occurred in, say, 2016, 2017, 2018. So right. there are some deals, but the trick is finding a deal where something's trading for a fraction of the ICO price, but like
right.
all these other fundamental things come into play and they're in your yeah. favor.
And it's a trade-off, right? Because on the one hand, you're not with the momentum when you invest in a bear market.
Right.
On the other hand, you have some of these other risks mitigated. If something is, you know, 10 times its ICO price, there's plenty of people who can sell at a massive profit and you might be buying from people who are very motivated to sell at that price.
Yeah.
On the other hand, 50% below the ICO price, there's less of that. And if you're buying, generally speaking, you're buying from somebody who has no intention of supporting the project for long term. This is where you get the disconnect between fundamentals and technicals. If you have a long-term perspective and there's a project where you really like the fundamentals, then it does make sense to, you know, there's nothing wrong with like trying whatever's at your disposal to try to get exposure to that project. If you try to time it too precisely, if you wait for things to already be moving the right direction, you know, that helps you in the short term if you try to time it potentially, because you can invest with momentum, you can be a swing trader. But if we're talking about fundamentals, just as soon as you have enough confidence, like once you have confidence in your system, like if you know which metrics really matter to you, whether it's the team or the token utility model, if you know what really matters to you and you've got enough confidence that you've collected the data to support your hypothesis, you know, it's this idea of just like higher slow, fire fast kind of a thing. It's the same sort of principle with investing. It's like do a ton of due diligence, but then when it's time to execute, don't don't get in your own head. You know, you need to have a system for execution as well. And that's where people get into trouble, where they've got a system for executing and no fundamental consideration, or they've got a system for evaluating projects and no system for execution. You need to, as you're developing your fundamental framework, be developing a framework that you can also use for how you decide the when and the where. And I would say, don't overthink it. If you like something, just find a way to get the liquidity you need, and hopefully don't try to chase after things that have no liquidity, because as we said, if you want to ever have an off ramp from your position,
you need somebody,
you need to take that into account.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we're already targeting contrarian investors, and this is actually a typical contrarian
at this point. Yep.
Contrarian investor setup. Well, and that's what you're doing. But in that environment, you can get stuck with some stuff that's not good. Like even it passed your smell test, and then all of a sudden you hear really bad stuff coming out. So one could be the team that's responsible for this project runs out of runway. They have no more money. That happens a ton, actually. You know, listeners will know that I've paid attention to like the uranium sector. And it's where you could have some sort of thesis for why nuclear will make a comeback and the price of uranium will go up. But it doesn't mean like every uranium miner is going to make it, because some of them could be straddled with debt that they took on in the downturn, right, or whatever. And the crypto space has more of that, because people could have ridden the price of Ethereum all the way down, and they could have bought expensive offices in 2017 that they can't afford now, and all that kind of stuff. So when you're looking at a project, how do you say, okay, I was wrong from a fundamental perspective, there's now news or something else that's come out that's changed my mind, and differentiate between price variation. So like if I believe in Enigma, the price could go down 20% with the rest of the market, and I could still believe in Enigma and choose to have another tranche, like another investment into the project at that lower price. But for some projects, I might also be learning, and I'll pick on Substratum because they were trading the rest of their money, you know, trying to increase their treasury. Like, and I could say, okay, that's a warning sign. I'm going to get out. How do you, as an investor, try to differentiate between these types of things, where the price is moving or news comes out, and you're trying to choose, do I cut this or do I ride it, double down, that kind of thing?
Yeah. I mean, again, it's depending on your horizon. If you are an investor who trades with leverage, if you've overextended yourself, you have to be more sensitive to short-term movements. You've put yourself at a disadvantage.
Certainly with leverage. But I think for the purpose of our conversation, we're mostly talking about people buying tokens for a altcoin.
Assume you've invested money you can afford to lose, and you're just trying to make good investment decisions over time. So if you see something that comes out and it fundamentally changes, again, if you've had a system in place, if you understand what metrics you value about a project, and something new comes out where it meaningfully changes your assessment of that project, you know, there's no reason to want to hold on for dear life, especially if you've already identified other opportunities. At the best you can, you know, you rebalance into the projects that you do support. The nice thing about this market right now, and I think in the market generally, is that there's very high correlations in these altcoins. So if there's a project that you dislike and it's crashing, there's probably also a project you like that's also crashing. So you're not like giving, like there's less opportunity cost to cutting bait, because you can rotate into something that you do like. There has to be something somewhere at some valuation you enjoy if you're still in this market at all. Like if you have any sort of long-term belief in this, you know, and I want to, you know, be clear, enough people, including you and me, have seen other market cycles to think that, you know, this is not the end of the game, especially if you can like pick a winner, right? Like there will be other opportunities. The opportunity, however, is not in, you know, clinging desperately to what you've already allocated yourself to. It's, you know, coming every day with clear eyes to be able to say, have my fundamental feelings about these projects changed? You know, has there been real new information, or have you learned something that was already like public, but it's new to you? Use that to reevaluate. If you're taking a short-term loss, you know, if there's slippage and trying to reallocate the tokens you dislike back to the things you like, you know, don't feel like, you know, oh, my bags are, you know, 50-50, so that's fair, even though I like this one five times more than the other. Don't do that to yourself. You know, like it's worth the pain short-term, taking the slippage of trying to reallocate that, because if you've got that long-term perspective, sooner than you think, you will regret not having taken action. And if we get back to a market where there's more liquidity and more price discovery and correlations start falling again to the point where things will move on their own, you are going to regret not having taken the opportunity to act when there were still these high correlations and there was significant, you know, alpha to be found.
And that's because the stuff, theoretically, the stuff that will be moving once we see some decorrelation will be things with fundamental drivers for why they're moving, versus something that's basically a zombie token is what I've been calling them, where it's dying along with the rest of the market, but it's not coming back.
That's what I mean. I mean, it's something that moves and moves for a reason, which is why it starts to decorrelate. And honestly, like if you're in this space, it's because you believe more capital is coming. It's because you believe more liquidity is coming. You believe that people are going to start believing more in these technologies, not less. And if you believe that, then you have to look at where that capital is going to go. And if you think that capital is smart money, if you think it's, you know, people who care deeply about the tech in this space, then you know it's going to go towards projects that have real tech and real teams, things that are, you know, going to look good to people who used to invest in the traditional space and use the same metrics. Like, is this tech groundbreaking? Is this team ethical and responsible and experienced? You know, that is going, if you believe that the space is going to grow, then I believe that you should think that those are going to be the fundamental drivers behind the next leg up, and that it's not going to drag necessarily the entire market up along with it. Some are going to benefit more than others, and there's going to be fundamental drivers for that.
I want to finish with network participation. So I think a lot of people, myself included, rarely do we buy into a token, especially if you're looking at things mostly from a technical perspective. But I could be looking at something from a technical perspective and also know I might be holding it for 6 months or more if I'm making a contrarian play right now. In that time, do you think there's value for me participating in the network in some way? Some networks you can run a node, some networks you can do some type of staking, some networks you could be a miner, or, you know, whatever types of participation that project may allow. What kind of inherent value do you think there is in doing that versus just tossing it on a hardware wallet and putting it in the closet for the next 6 years or 6 months to a year? Hopefully not 6 years.
So there's risk and reward. The reward is, you know, if there's some sort of ROI associated with that activity, if there's staking rewards, if there's fees associated with staking and running a node in the network, and you can get more rewards than it costs to run the node, then, you know, it is free money. The risk is the lack of liquidity. You know, if you have to lock up those tokens in a smart contract, or, you know, if you have no access, that's a risk. If there's no liquidity for the token anyway, that shouldn't bother you. But if it is the sort of thing where you'd want to get in and out of it, it's a consideration that you'd make. On the other hand, you know, if there's some other kind of utility for the token where you'd be spending it on the network, that's a different consideration. You know, then you're weighing it against, you know, is it better to hold this token or use the token to speculate versus using the token to consume services with this product or network? Most of all, what I would say is, you know, if you're like a really good profitable trader, like these costs are higher because you want to have the flexibility. Liquidity is great for you. If you're not a very good trader, or if you just know, like as an active trader, like you're not making more money than just kind of sitting on your hands, then the return of participating in these networks beyond like the tokens you might get for participating and like getting these rewards is the learning. And that is so critical. If you're going to be long-term in this space, you want to learn how these networks work, how these products work, how to interact with them, and like become a user beyond just becoming like an investor or speculator. Like you want to know how these technologies work, then you have to participate in these networks. And there's a huge return to you intellectually associated with that. You gotta take that chance. You know, if you're not going to trade these things, I implore you to participate in the networks that you're supporting by holding their tokens. And if there is no way to support the networks that you're, you know, supporting by holding their tokens, maybe reevaluate which networks you're supporting, because there really should be.
Yeah. Well, you're getting to what I wanted to be my final question. So I appreciate that, which is the native value of a utility token concept and how you think of the risks of that. whether it's from an investment perspective, obviously there's risks from a regulatory perspective because at least in the US, entities have really not made it very clear in terms of what's okay, what's not okay. But let's just stick with the value of the network effects concept and that kind of thing, like inherently creating value in a token that is part of a network. And how do you evaluate that? How do you think, okay, well, this token has value when it's not equity in a company? It's it's ownership of a token that's used in an ecosystem in some way.
Yeah, it's easier to... So first of all, not all tokens are created equal, right? And Chris Bernisky's done a lot of work on this point with you know, developing the crypto assets framework and just kind of pointing out there's things that are stores of value, there's things that are means of exchange, there's things that are, you know, utility tokens on a network, there's tokens you can stake and get a return, there's, you know, tokens that you consume for a service. Like there's, these all have very different fundamental valuation models, just like the way that like different business models in the traditional world, you would evaluate differently. A platform strategy is very different from a laundromat. And yet these, all of these things can be powered by digital currencies or crypto assets. So being able to take a step back and say, just because something's next to something else on coinmarketcap.com does not make them equivalent, right? Like that seems plainly obvious, but that's the way that we measure things. It's the one thing that everybody seems to agree on is that the price that something is today is the best way to measure it because it's the same no matter where you are. Everybody can see it. I would caution people and say get away from that because I think our fundamental valuation frameworks are going to shift. And if new money comes in and they have different valuation models and that money is bigger than the capital that's currently in these markets, the prices in the markets are going to change. Supply and demand is going to meaningfully shift based on these new opinions that are entering market. Markets is just opinions trading against each other. And if their opinion is bigger than your opinion, it doesn't matter how right you think you are. You know, it matters what the biggest money's opinion is. And what I'm seeing is that the biggest money believes in the value of tokens that have actual utility on a network. You know, security tokens are separate. Things that give you equity in a company, things that would give you like entitlement to a cash flow up from the company's revenue, that's one thing. But for utility tokens specifically, you know, I believe in things where it's like you can stake the token in the network or tokens are paid in fees in the network. And so like computational demand is associated with the value of the token. Like things like that are easier for me to understand than it's like there's a service continually provided and you need to trade the tokens for that service. You know, it's like, how is that different from like if the service was denominated in dollars? Like why is there a need for a crypto token? So I would leave it by saying, if you can't figure out why this thing needs a token, it's very unlikely that the token has value.
If you can, even though it may be trading,
if you can understand why the token, sorry, say that again.
Even though it may be trading currently with value.
Yeah. Even though it may be trading currently with value, because again, the price on an exchange that you see is the fundamental value plus the speculative value. Speculative value is healthy because that's the only way you can say to yourself, is this thing going to still be a thing in 10 years? That is speculative value. Doesn't mean that the way they're pricing the speculative value is right. It could be that this thing's going to be totally useless in 10 years and there will be no utility to the token and the speculative value should be zero, but traders are assigning it higher. But that sort of thing is something that doesn't like settle, you know, like you don't, that you never find out tomorrow. You only care about what the value of that's going to be 10 years from now. And only 10 years from now, us is going to be able to say for sure. You just have to be careful that yeah, the market can stay irrational longer than you can stay solvent, but if you believe that the new capital coming in is actually going to care about the utility of tokens and actually going to care about how they're used, then continuing to do this thing where we don't care how tokens are used, we only care what they're worth or what we think the next trader is going to be willing to buy it for, you are going to have a very uncomfortable time when the market changes.
Yeah, and I think things are different. I think there's a sweet spot for that too. It's all part of the market cycle more broadly, but like if you picture the classic market cycle, I think as you work your way down to the bottom, like you said earlier, the good stuff bleeds, the bad stuff bleeds, it all bleeds. You find your deals there. You find your deals there in the good stuff while the bad stuff should theoretically go to zero or close to it. But then there's this part of the cycle where you're in a recovery phase, but you're not into like a hype phase where mm-hmm. I think that's really where some of the differences are going to be made. And that's partly why I wanted to have this conversation, is because I think we're getting at least closer to where people need to think of it that way, because we're going to get to this place where things start to decorrelate, where value goes to better fundamental projects. And then maybe some of that fundamental value criteria will go out the window again once we get back to a full-on hype cycle, another bubble, all that kind of stuff. But that could be years down the road.
And I think you're spot on. I think that's a very fair assessment for how these cycles kind of play out, which is that, you know, this might be the moment that smart money was waiting for before the next hype cycle begins, where they can consolidate their positions in the projects they do fundamentally support and want to support long-term. So, you know, look out for seeing that money come in, look out for big names choosing to support the networks directly and not just, you know, support the speculative value of the token. Those are going to be the signals you want to see when you're deciding where to participate longer term. And then, as you say, if there's another hype cycle after that, all bets are off. But from here to then, there's indefinite amount of time where, you know, hopefully this is where a lot of stuff actually launches and gets utility. And that's, as a builder, that's the most exciting thing to see.
Yeah. And I agree. And as a speculator, I am trying to think more about what the decoupling will look like, what the decorrelation will look like, and how can I be on the right side of that? Because, you know, I don't want to throw something in there into a coin because it's got a chart that I like, and I failed to look at all these other aspects. So you and I were talking about this from a token valuation perspective before. I thought you'd be a good person to come on the show, and I think that's proven out. So thanks for coming on. And hey, you have a podcast, you've got a project you're working on, and you've got Twitter. Show your stuff, man. I want to know, let people know where they can follow you and why they should.
So it's showtime. Yeah. All right. Yeah, man. So Enigma, the project, if you're curious about it, go to www.enigma.co or go to blog.enigma.co. A lot of the stuff there is stuff I've written, but it's also stuff that Guy has written, our co-founder John has written, our whole dev team, our business development team. We post all the time. We got a Telegram, which is Enigma Project. But if you're mostly curious about like hearing more thinking about like where this space is going and the fundamentals, I do have a podcast under the Enigma umbrella, which is called Decentralize This. If you go to blog.enigma.co/podcast, you'll see all of our episodes. We've had some really cool guests on. We just had Alex from IDEX. Before that, we had Andrew Keys from Consensus. Our first guest was Joey Krug, who actually guided a lot of my thinking about these fundamental frameworks that I use. So there's some really great stuff there. It's also on iTunes and Spotify. But it's always a pleasure to come on stuff like this, because I feel like it's, again, these are all valuable perspectives in the space. Together, we're all the connective tissue of where these technologies are going to go. There's no way, as I said, to separate really the fundamental and the technical and the speculative value of all of these technologies and all of the underlying assets. It's, you have to take it as a whole, and you're doing an awesome job, man, trying to keep it all together and trying to educate people.
And, you know, I think that's true what you're talking about, this this weird relationship between speculators and builders, whether it's the crypto ecosystem, where there's over the past couple of years been a lot more speculation than building, or whether it's the traditional markets where sometimes you have 100-year-old companies with lots of building and the speculation's not that high because people kind of know the value of those companies. And then there's tech in the traditional world where sometimes it's somewhere in the middle. And it's a push and pull relationship between investors and makers. And so
listen to my episode with Joey Krug, because Joey is a builder and he's an investor. He's at Pantera. And he says that investing in the crypto space is like investing in biotech companies. And it was a super good episode and a super good analogy. And it was the very first one. So I would encourage anybody who wants to get started with the Decentralized This podcast, just go straight to episode one, listen to Joey. He's nice. A smart guy. Pantera's been in this a long time.
Yeah, I'll link it up. I appreciate it, Taurus. Good talking to you. And we'll catch everybody next time.
Awesome. Thanks for having me, man. Monuments crumble. Blink of an eye, the easy river has just run dry in a house.